So today I'm going to talk about a much more specific group, which is this frontotemporal dementia, and I'm comparing it to an early onset Alzheimer's disease sample. And it's a pretty small sample because it's a pretty rare dementia. In terms of disclosures, I don't have any relationship to disclose. Just briefly, I'm going to go over what caregiving is and how we define it, present a research question, briefly describe our methodology, provide you some results, and what the conclusion and implications of this work would be. In terms of, we've talked a lot about caregivers and what informal caregivers are, and basically what they are they carry out a lot of the functional and instrumental activities of daily living of individuals. So it's beyond just this minimal interchange or interactions you would have or would do to others. So it really, it's assumed a significant responsibility to take care of or impair relatives and sometimes even friends. In terms of the impact of informal caregiving on society, a report in 2009 estimated that about 65.7 million people in the U.S. provide informal unpaid care for some adults, some level of impairment. That's an estimated value of about $415 billion, which is twice that of what would pay a documented formal long-term care. So it's very substantial. And this is just informal of what can be calculated, so it probably would be greater. This is actually expected to increase with the aging of the baby boom population. There's expected increased cost and need, and also there's probably going to be a decreased number of people able to provide care. I'm going to talk to you about the population that we work on in the clinic that I and the research that we do. So we work with these particular rare dementias that usually occur, and I identify the early onset dementia that occur before age 65. That's the criteria that we use. The mean age of development is between 40 and 50 years old. There's about, according to the Alzheimer's Association, there's about 200,000 cases, which is about 4 to 6% of the documented dementia population. But please keep in mind that often these are very rare dementias that go undiagnosed. So we really don't have a true estimate of how many people actually have an early onset dementia. Within these early onset dementias, we have frontotemporal dementia. Specifically, the group that I'm talking to you about today is a subgroup within the FTD spectrum, which is behavioral variant FTD. And I'm looking behavioral variant FTD patients present usually with changes in personality, behavior, personal conduct, less of insight, increased apathy, and marked decline in executive ability. So this is very different than what your typical late onset or even amnestic cognitive dementia patient would present. Then you have the, in my comparison group is actually the early onset Alzheimer's disease patients, which tend to be more similar to your late onset or what you know to be dementia or Alzheimer's disease with predominant memory loss. And some of them do have some language impairment, depending on where the disability or where the disease starts. What we know in terms of FTD caregiver research is very limited. There's only a handful of studies that actually looked at FTD. What it suggests is that compared to early Alzheimer's disease, FTD caregivers have a greater burden and more, and they express more emotional distress. However, because of numbers, a lot of studies combine FTD spectrum, which would include some of your language components. So this study looks specifically at behavioral variant FTD to isolate the effects of behavior on caregiver burden. So my question today is, what is what impact do social and emotional disturbances have on dementia caregivers? And taking advantage of looking at behavioral variant FTD and early onset DIAD will help us better understand what the social and emotional stressors really mean to the caregiver and how that may be a factor adding to these speculated changes or greater burden that's expressed by our FTD caregivers. In terms of methodologies, just for the data, this is part of a parent R01 study that studied social and emotion in patients with frontotemporal dementia and compared behavioral variant FTD patients with early onset AD. And you looked at different we looked at different components. We looked at patients' behaviors. We looked at we did psychophysiology to see reactivity in patients when we present different scenarios. We also did some structural imaging to look at changes and comparisons across both groups. This was not intended to be a caregiver study, but we added some components to be able to see how the caregivers reacted or how they felt in terms of their caregiver experience. So we, out of this, we linked our patient data with our caregiver data, and we were able to make comparisons. And we did some descriptive statistics to be able to compare the difference between FTD or FTD and early onset AD patients. We collected demographics. We collected caregiver scales that looked at demographics. We information on the severity burden inventory, a depression scale. Also collected information on the number of neuropsych symptoms, and the distress tells you how distressful these caregivers would find some of the symptoms. Then we had a huge battery of information on patients. So I picked some of the, just to hit different domains, just general demographics to see how similar the patient population was. We also used that as a global score of cognition to make a comparison across both groups. We looked at the Mini-Mental. Then we also looked at functions, how different are they in function. And we used a functional scale that looked at some of the executive components. Then the neuropsych inventory patient, it makes an inventory of the kind of psychiatric symptoms the patient may be exhibiting. Person's absence, the severity, and the frequency of these particular symptoms. Then we added some emotional scales to look at emotion, changes of emotion after the onset of the illness. And this is actually responses by the caregiver in terms of changes in emotion. And then we looked at, we asked patients in terms of their views of social rules. So that's the social dysfunction scale. And then there's this global measure of executive or frontal type of dysfunction, that's the free suite that looks at a lot of the same domains. In terms of results, there was very little difference. As you can see, it's a pretty early onset group with very high education. They come from, most of our patients come from our clinics. They're at UCLA, so it's a pretty wealthy population, highly educated. Our population is predominantly Caucasian or white, and we don't see a lot of this particular illness. It's reported to occur highly on a Caucasian population. Most of our patients were married and had a mean onset of about 3 to 4 years. And in terms of the caregivers, they're also under 65, so it's a pretty young caregiver population itself. They're also highly educated, predominantly female for the FTD population. Also pretty, it's predominantly Caucasian. Most of them are the spouses, and they tend to live with them. So not a lot of them were institutionalized at the time that we saw them. In terms of how they are, you can see in terms of differences between or this particular group of early onset dementias, so or FTD caregivers, they tend to be pretty similar in terms of cognition, still pretty impaired, but in terms of function, the executive function components, or FTD caregivers are highly much more impaired. They show a lot more emotional blunting, highly significant. They tend to have a lot more psychiatric symptoms with higher severity and frequency. Also, there's a lot of higher disturbance of social norms for FTD care patients. And then also on the FISBID, which is this overall scale of frontal dysfunction, our FTD patients tend to be pretty disturbed. And then looking at what happens, what's going on with the caregivers of this particular population, we notice that our FTD caregivers are significantly much more depressed, and they tend to be also show more report higher distress on some of the psychiatric the presence of psychiatric symptoms by these patients. Plus, they have a lot more burn than your other than your comparison early onset AD group. So, we started looking in terms of what is it that would explain the differences. And if you notice, our sample is pretty small, so what I can present to you, it's pretty descriptive information. We have the nature of doing this type of work is that it's a pretty rare dimension. We can only account for a few cases of truly diagnosed. So a lot of work pretty much going in terms of trying to understand from them. So what I did was I took the SERET, which is much more of a global idea in terms of what's going on with patients, what is actually bothering caregivers. And I made a comparison of all the items within the SERET. And what I found was there's a groupings of items tend to be much more significantly where our FTD caregivers tend to have higher burden. And just to adjust for multiple comparisons, I did a Bonferroni. And if you notice, our FTD caregivers tend to say that they're a lot more embarrassed over relatives' behaviors. That causes them a lot of burden. They feel very uncomfortable having friends over because of relatives. Those are some of the predominant significant components. But some of the other domains are very socially driven. So they're social. The patient's performance or the way the patients act, and some of some of their psychiatric symptoms tend to actually create a lot more burden for this particular population. And then if you look a little bit more, you see that they're more likely to start contemplating institutionalizing their loved ones, and also have feeling less control, being more out of control in terms of handling the caregiver role. Just in terms of summary of results, our behavioral FTD patients were significantly more impaired in psychiatric, executive, behavioral, emotional domains than early onset AD patients. The behavioral variant FTD caregivers reported significant greater depression burden due to caregiving than EOD caregivers. And lastly, the behavioral variant FTD caregivers reported that patients' social dysfunction to be significantly more burdensome than EOD caregivers. So this talks about how different, even within, we talk about these early or rare dementias, within them, there's the driving forces of what's actually making these caregivers feel more burdened are a different set of factors. In terms of conclusion, that just to say that behavioral variant patients' social and emotional dysfunction may have a huge consequences on the caregiver's own psychological well-being, social life, and it may contribute to their ability to provide care. It talks a lot about if these behaviors and the patient's social conduct actually drives caregivers to maybe be more socially isolated and could probably explain some of the depressive symptoms that we see under caregivers. So there's a lot of components. In terms of implications and significance, and I think this is where I was going in terms of what's important is to identify that we have different dementias. As he described, that this big umbrella, there's a lot of different symptoms that the patients are undergoing. And, you know, doctors do manage symptoms at a different level. But when you think of caregiver burden, you think of one thing, and it's not. There's different components that may actually be leading to how these caregivers are feeling. So when we think of caregiver interventions, then we have to really start distinguishing about the symptomology, what is going on, and really tailor some of these interventions to the needs of these caregivers so that we can be more effective. So for future interventions, really consider disease specific social dysfunctions when you think of FTD population, and how do we deal with some of these dysfunctions to be able to alleviate some of the needs. And also some of the nursing homes. A lot of our nursing home patients are not able to stay because they're different than what you would suspect on this dementia population. And a lot of the nursing homes do not expect this dementia patient to have this range, wide range of social dysfunction or behavioral dysfunction. This is very descriptive. It's a small sample, and this is the part of my dissertation. Actually, what I did was now I went in. I also collected in-depth interviews, so I'm trying to get more. I'm working through the qualitative data to get more predominant things and see exactly what domains or areas or behavioral or early onset caregivers, and then kind of start dividing between groups to see what are some of the issues that they find to be more burdensome, some of the issues that actually are helpful to them, and what it is that they want in terms of interventions. Just to acknowledge some of the groups that helped with this paper, and then thank you. I don't know if you have any questions.
Okay. Any questions for our speaker?
Have you started to discuss caregiver interventions? I really appreciate your paper and making that distinction and the stress on caregivers. Have you started to discuss that among your group?
We do. You know, that's actually how I came into this work, because I as a research assistant, I would come in and be in the room with a nurse practitioner. And a great part of what I noticed was that we had this invisible patient, which was the caregiver, and we have a very special clinic with a nurse practitioner that would spend an hour really tailoring intervention based on where they were. And the other component is that care is not static. Where our patients start, it's different in a year. So our interventions have to be take into account this trajectory where they start are going to be somewhat different. So our interventions at the beginning are different than when we see them in a year or 6 months. So there are different behavioral interventions for the caregivers. The needs are different. I mean, this particular population is young onset. So there was one patient that they were dealing with, helping with the family structure, because it's a family illness. So you're dealing with younger children that they're parenting to. So how do you assist them with some of this component? So it's case management in a very different setting than what you would expect on your late onset. So it was very tailored. So based seeing this and how tailored the interventions were needed, and how the lack of resources ready to be able to serve this population was pretty evident, because we couldn't, or early on, our early onset caregivers didn't feel comfortable going to a support group with older people. They have different concerns. Most of them are spouses. They're dealing with emotional components also. So you had to really come up with very few, we have very few support groups and services for this population. So I think there's been some work to be able to bring more resources to them. But we've been kind of utilizing what's out there. That's what our clinic does. Yeah.
We have a question in the back.
Have you ever, I guess,
with
the patient population, do you have anybody that has a long-term care insurance policy that they can utilize?
Yes. So what the interesting thing about this population in terms of resources, it's a much more affluent population, so a lot of them come in with, they have, so they may not go to a nursing home, but they do have people to come into their house and help them, because that gives caregivers some of their respite. And that actually works better, because oftentimes our patients will get will tend to be not stay, they will be sent home from nursing homes because of their unmanaged behaviors.
Thanks. We have 5 more minutes, so questions for any of the presenters, or if, that would include our final speaker as well. So we still do have 5 minutes. Yes?
I'm not sure how to frame my question because it's actually overlapping two of them. You actually, so first of all, these facets, it's nice to have such a big environment to learn. You had a slide that was a little confusing to me because you showed the projected numbers. You had a tapering, a leveling off of one age category, and then an acceleration.
Yes.
One of the things that I noticed is I've been reading a little bit about some optimism in some groups about a tapering off, a leveling of the rate of Alzheimer's behavior changes. On the other hand, it strikes me that some of the groups that have a higher rate, such as San Diego, may be reflective of less early intervention behavioral changes for prevention. So
you're talking about that slide with the projections?
Yeah, like
right, yeah. So in the interest of time, I didn't dwell on that. But that was mainly a baby boomer cohort effect is really what it comes down to. So in the years 2040 and 2050, toward the end of the kind of the right-hand side of the line graphs, the 75 to 84 group actually exceeded the 85 and older group. And that was mainly because the baby boomers are going to be in that 75. It really is due to a larger denominator, if you will, in the younger, in the 75 to 84 versus the 85 and older. We can talk offline about that, but that's really more what it is. It's not related to this literature that you are referring to, which is, you know, very provocative literature.
Showing a little too optimistic because again, that's just an isolated group that may be benefiting for very aggressive lifestyle changes.
Okay. Now this was really purely based on demographics. Yeah. It was a good pickup, though. Yes?
I also have a question for you, Richard. Actually, two questions, if I can make them quick. First, with MFSB, I understand you could not, or your group decided not to promote it because it's copyrighted. I'm curious, though, did it make both lists, NIA and Alzheimer's Association, or recommended?
Excuse me. No, it didn't, because the free part was actually part of their criteria.
Okay.
You see what I mean? Right. Yeah.
Okay. That was a good, quick answer. So now I have time for my other question, which was I'm wondering, and you sort of alluded to perhaps the answer in your talk, but why did you opt not to just screen everyone with one of these free screeners? And, you know, you talked about the potential for physicians prematurely diagnosing, which I think may have played a role, and maybe, unnecessary healthcare utilization associated with those screenings. So, can you just talk about that?
Right. Well, it turned out that, well, the first thing we wanted to do was base our recommendations on evidence. I mean, we really tried to focus on that. And it just turned out that during the year 2014, when we were really doing our, you know, the bulk of our work, late in the year was when the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force released their systematic review and their recommendations about the relative cost benefit of doing universal screening. And they came down on the side that there was simply not enough evidence that the cost of doing universal screening would outweigh the cost did outweigh the benefits of testing everyone and yielding false positives and things like that. I mean, that's really what it came down to. We decided, particularly because we have a lot of representatives from sister federal agencies, to entities like the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, we did not want to come out essentially in opposition to this systematic review that was released right at the time our work group was doing our work. And coming, we spent a lot of time debating amongst the work group whether to recommend universal screening or not. And it continues to be a raging debate. There's no clear answer to it. We also had representatives from consumer-oriented organizations that basically said you shouldn't scare every older person who comes into the primary care office by throwing a cognitive test at them out of left field almost. And that's why we came down on the side of saying the very first thing to do is to open up the conversation.
about cognition, because there's actually a lot of mostly epidemiological work, again, and a lot of you in the room might know this already, that shows that with lifestyle changes, there have been associations shown between changing lifestyle for the better on the one hand and reducing risk of developing dementia later in life. And so we didn't want to discount that work either. And so we at least wanted to allow primary care providers to say, you don't have memory problems now, you're not worried about it now, you're a 70 or 75 year old male or female. Evidence shows that it's possible to reduce your risk of developing dementia in the decades of life that you might have left if you change your lifestyle even now. And we decided to err on that side rather than saying, let's just do your universal screening. So that was the logic. But it was a raging debate, I'll tell you that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. Right. And not to put a plug out there, but the Alzheimer's Association does have the 10 warning signs of dementia. Again, a lot of you might know about that already. And that's a good example. And, primary care providers and specialists, for that matter, who are aware of that material will have brochures like that in their offices, the 10 warning signs of dementia. But that's far from universal at this point, having that information available. Yeah. Yes.
Just, I don't know if this is a final comment or whatever, but I want to say that if you want to have part two, we're going to be in this room next door in a half an hour, and we're going to talk about what the Illinois Alzheimer's Center has done to kind of pull some things together, focusing on the public health system. And we also have a couple of family caregivers and a person with dementia.
Thank you. Well, let's have a hand for all of the presenters, okay?